Welcome. Today on this call, I have a very special guest. My guest is Mark Turok, and if you haven't heard of him, he is the founder or the head person of AmericanParkour.com and quite an expert in this art, which I'm sure you're familiar with if you're listening to this right now. It's kind of taken the world by storm in recent years, just spreading out wide. And so for anyone looking to get started in this art, we're going to be talking about that and what you can do on today's call. So thanks for joining us, Mark.
Excellent. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Let's just get started for anyone that might not be too familiar with it. What is parkour?
Sure. Parkour is a discipline that involves using obstacles in your surroundings as a training method, basically. So there's a couple of ways to view it, and it makes it kind of hard to define. So I'll go through a couple of ways that we look at it. One is a lot of people feel that parkour is just getting from place A to place B as quickly as possible. And that's kind of an outcome of parkour training. But the real training is training your body to be able to overcome obstacles through really taking inefficient paths, through doing difficult things. It's more efficient to walk up a flight of stairs than it is to climb an 8-foot wall. It's also safer. But we climb the 8-foot wall so that when that's what's available, we have that facility. So it's training yourself to be able to overcome obstacles. And really, it's the benefit that you get from going through that training that are both physical and mental. It can be used as exercise, as fun, but also going through anything difficult like that, which is progressive and considered as a discipline, certainly has mental benefits as well.
Okay, I think that was a great explanation. Let's talk a little bit about the history. How did parkour get started?
Sure. A multiple answer question. So we can go back and really, when I oversimplify it, I say that parkour is just another word for play. If we look back through human development, humans used to run, jump, climb, crawl, throw, defend, all kinds of things as part of their daily activity. When we move to recent civilized culture, we start to drop some of those things. Most people nowadays can go through their life without ever physically defending themselves. Many people go through their life without ever running, which I think is kind of sad, or without climbing or without jumping. So these are things that humans have always done, and frankly, we've gotten away from with our whole idea of the advancement of civilization and sort of separating ourselves from animals. So one way to look at the history of parkour is the rehabilitation of humans as animals and being able to go back to these capabilities that we used to have. Every human used to have the ability to pull themselves up over a ledge. Now I bet there are a lot of people that don't have that capability. So we're retraining that capability. So that's going back to the really long view history of when did parkour get started. Really, when people started to run on 2 feet and go anywhere and catch food or run to not be food themselves is the basis of it. But then in more recent years, we fast forward to the early, I believe it's early 1900s, where we have Georges Hébert. I apologize for anyone who speaks French. I'm going to butcher every French word that I say. But he came up with this thing called the méthode naturelle, which was this method for exercise, which involves climbing, running, jumping, throwing, swimming, and defending. And all of those things were done without real weights, without modern mechanisms, just using body weight or climbing a tree or carrying a log or a rock or carrying a rock underwater. So different implements that you would find in nature. And this training got handed down through the French military, eventually to David Bell's father, Raymond Bell, who is a firefighter. And in France, firefighters are it's a military position. And I believe that David Bell's father was also in Vietnam, in what we think of as the military, but I would have to verify that. But David Raymond Bell then passes down a lot of these moves that he learns to David Bell. And Raymond Bell is also a champion rope climber and just an amazing guy physically. So then David Bell starts gymnastics at a young age, has martial arts experience, and has this stuff kind of passed down from his father. And frankly, there's a lot of different views at this point on the real history of parkour, but essentially a group of guys called the Yamakaze start to play at very young age, say between 10 and 13 in the schoolyard, and imagine the game tag played with martial arts intensity. So now almost everyone, every kid, if they were in a game of tag, runs up to a bench, they're not going to stop and say, okay, you got me. They're going to climb over the bench, jump over the bench, crawl under the bench, do something to avoid being tagged. Imagine just doing that over and over and over to actually create what becomes this art form. So that's David Bell, Sebastian Foucan, and other members of the Yamakaze do this in France, and I'm going to say kind of early 90s is when it really starts to form into something.
That's great. Some people have different ideas. Could you go a little bit into the differences between parkour and free running?
Sure. And again, it's hard. American Parkour recently got together this past summer and got the whole community involved in creating a definition for parkour. And not everyone in the world agrees with that definition, and not everyone in the world agrees with our definition of free running. So I need to preface that there are multiple definitions out there, and we use the ones that we feel are the most descriptive and, frankly, the most beneficial, because you can give something a definition, but if people don't understand that, then the definition is sort of self-limiting. So our definitions are meant to be inclusive and meant to describe to people what parkour and free running are, and I just want to release that with the caveat that there are other definitions out there. So again, our definition of parkour is the training of overcoming obstacles so that you can move quickly and efficiently when the time comes. And then when we look at free running actually has at its base a lot of those same moves, but a different purpose. The purpose in free running isn't to get somewhere as quickly as possible. It's not to move as you would in an emergency situation. And so free running adds this element of, in my opinion, exploration. So let's say that I go to a space, and if I'm doing what would be termed as parkour, I would be trying to get across that space as quickly as possible, no matter what was in my way. If I'm doing free running, I may run up to something and interact with it, run up a tree and do a backflip. So free running necessarily, I shouldn't say necessarily, free running tends to have more acrobatics and more moves that appear to be expressions of freedom and creativity than parkour does, because free running is not defined by the purpose of getting somewhere quickly.
Hmm. Okay. That's good. Let me ask you, how did you get started in parkour?
Sure. I was living in London in 2002, and I saw a video from David Bell called Rush Hour, which was out on, I think it was the BBC, and they had done this video with David Bell, and it was just amazing. And Rush Hour is still one of the kind of popular jump-in points for people to see on YouTube and get started. And it's the video where he's running along these buildings to get home to watch his favorite television show. But he's doing backflips between buildings, and he does this massive gap jump and some other stuff that's just amazing. And I saw this, and I thought, wow, this guy is obviously amazing. There are no wires here, there are no pads, and it's very obvious. When you see movies now, you know that someone's on a wire. You know they're being pulled around and that they don't actually possess this capability. Whereas when I saw this video of David Bell, the opposite was immediately apparent. He possessed this capability. He was doing these things. He was doing these moves. He's in a world made of concrete and glass and gravel, and he is pushing himself through that world in a way that's different than any other human being, and really an example of human potential and what a human can train themselves to do. And so I saw that, and I was hugely inspired by that. And I thought, well, I'm never going to be David Bell. I'm never doing a backflip between two buildings. However, I might be able to jump off a curb or jump off a bench or get somewhere along that path that David Bell is the endpoint example of. So I basically I started to Google it a lot and didn't find a lot of info on it. All the forums for it were strictly in French, and they weren't necessarily looking for English-speaking people to come in and join their club. So Eventually, I found a bunch of guys in London, and we went out and trained. And for them, they had already been together a couple of times. And that group was Urban Free Flow. And so I joined up with that group and was with those guys for about 2 years until I moved back to the States and started up American Parkour.
Okay. Well, now that we've kind of gone over all the history of it, I'd like to dive in and talk about the training specifically. But before we begin that, you talked about how really parkour is about learning how to move your body in different ways. And most people, they can't even do a pull-up or pull themselves over a ledge. What kind of shape should someone be in before they begin? Is there a minimum of strength and coordination you should acquire using even more basic exercises before you start attempting these moves in parkour?
That's a great question. It's one of our most frequent questions. And my answer to it is that things should be done in parallel. So the level of parkour that you do certainly has a... you could assign a level of fitness to do that safely. But what I would say is that parkour really can be scaled to any level, just like I believe exercise can be scaled to any level. And so a person should start where they are. I have a lot of people, I have the gym in DC, Primal Fitness, and an incredible number of people say to me, I'm going to come to your gym as soon as I get in shape. And I'm just dumbfounded by that. I don't even know what to say to them. I just say okay, and I smile, and I pat them on the back, and I walk away. So really, someone can begin training in parkour at whatever level of fitness they're at, but it has to be scaled properly, just like someone can start exercise at whatever level they're at, but it has to be scaled properly. So I would say if someone is overweight and out of shape, they shouldn't be jumping off something that's 2 feet tall. They're just going to hurt their knees. But they can jump off something that's 6 inches tall, and they can do that repeatedly as a conditioning along with a conditioning program. So what we found at Primal Fitness when we first started teaching people parkour, it was kind of a comedic disaster. Our first parkour course was a three-hour intro session to parkour, and we brought in people at kind of what I'll call normal average fitness levels, which ranged anywhere from probably not so great to some pretty fit people. And we ran them all through 3 hours of teaching them parkour moves. And at the end of it, people were like literally lying on the floor, clutching their knees and rolling around. And we realized, okay, we can't just teach people the movements in parkour. We need to set some serious conditioning along with this. So now, and we're a CrossFit affiliate, and we use methods from CrossFit and things very similar to CrossFit. We do all our own programming, but if you look at CrossFit's methodology, we follow something fairly similar. So now our parkour class is a 6-week, 18-class boot camp where someone gets equal parts conditioning, parkour training, and cool-down stretching. So those things all grow together, and that's much healthier for someone. That allows them to bring up their conditioning, push-ups, pull-ups, squats, box jumps, things like that, at the same time as they're learning these parkour moves, and it gives them a level of fitness that allows them to learn more of the parkour movements.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, when people watch these parkour videos on the internet or wherever, they see the amazing moves that people can do and they want to get right into that, but you really do need to form that foundation with foundational exercises before you should begin.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, to compare it to a handstand, you wouldn't have a person who's 50 pounds overweight. You don't say, okay, stand on your hands.
Yeah.
Right? You have to give them some exercises, you give them some moves and a means to get there. You're not telling them not to start practicing handstands. You're saying practice it here, and here's the path, and here's your means to get to this level.
And the truth is, by following that path instead of going directly for the move, you're going to get a lot further in the long run than you would just going straight for the, you know, whatever exercise they immediately want to do.
Absolutely. And this is a good place for me to plug safety and how important safety is in parkour. We absolutely put safety first. So if you see a video of a kid jumping off a garage and you go out and you try and jump off your garage, you probably will break your ankle. And have to say, don't do that. Start slow, start small, start progressively, do it experimentally. Do not just run out and jump off of something. You will get hurt. So we teach people landing and rolling is 6 full hours of instruction before they learn any other move, even vaulting over a 3-foot box. They've had 6 hours of landing and rolling, and that time helps them build up proprioception in their ankles and just learning where their body is in space and how to land and how to roll and how to distribute that force, and that is essential. So again, you can't just go jump off things. And even for very advanced practitioners, we don't recommend ever doing a move where the consequences of missing are fatality. So if you're gonna jump over a gap, there's very little difference between jumping over a gap that's 2 2x4s placed 10 feet apart on the ground and jumping between a gap that's 2 buildings that are 10 feet apart and 2 stories up. Physically, it's the exact same requirement. Mentally, someone takes years to develop to the point where they are able to do that. So we don't want to see people just seeing a parkour video and climbing up on their roof. That's absolutely backwards. Really, you need to start small, go through tutorials, learn the basics, and build up.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. So let's talk a little bit more. How would someone get started? You talked about a few of the foundational moves, especially landing and rolling. So could you go more into that, and where does someone go from there?
Sure. At the risk of sounding like a plug, on AmericanParkour.com, we have the tutorials. We also have a tutorial DVD, which is available on your site, and that's a huge help. So I think the two most important things are, one, understanding what the basic moves and the progression of those moves are, and two, seeking other people to do that with. So one of the things that we're really big on at APK is the forums, and going to your forum for your local state, finding your local state's parkour website, finding a meetup group, finding them on Facebook, whatever that is, and again, you can find all that by going through APK. We list all the different sites in the different states and even different countries, so people can find their local group and go out and train with them. And everyone in parkour is really helpful and friendly. I've never heard of an instance where someone walked up to someone that was doing parkour and said, "Hey, can you show me how to do that?" And the person said no. I should say, with extremely few exceptions, if a guy is training and he's jamming something really hard and he's in the middle of a workout, he may say, "Hey, you know what, I can't right now, but come back in an hour." But they're not going to say no. And so people in this parkour community are really friendly and really helpful to each other. And to me, that's the best way to learn, is to go out and actually do it and learn from people who know what they're doing.
Right, yeah. Just looking at parkour, it is a very community-oriented thing. Is there any other tips you'd have as far as finding other people that can help you train? Or did you cover it all right there?
Really, that's the basis of it. Go to American Parkour, go to the forums, or go to our links directory, and you can see the websites listed by state, or if you just post up in one of our forums and say, "Hey, I'm in this city in this state," someone will answer you usually fairly quickly. Now, we've got people in all 50 states, and we get visitors from 165 countries every month. So if you post up that you're somewhere in the world, someone else will post up that they're pretty close to you and they can get together and train with you. So the other thing to remember, again, when you're talking about getting started, start slow, train safe. Train with safety in mind. There's always tomorrow. And so many people, it's like you said, the person who takes the correct path to get there is going to get there much faster than someone who just dives in head first. Because if you dive in head first, you're putting yourself prone for injury. You're putting yourself prone for things that you really don't need to be at risk for. And taking the proper training path will actually get you there much faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, since obviously we're on the call right here, and we won't go too in-depth in the moves because, one, it will be just difficult to figure out what we're saying from that, and you really should. Videos are good, but like you were saying, Mark, just finding someone you can train with, that's going to be the best way that you can get better in doing this. So let's move on to another subject. How do you find a good place to train, and what are you specifically looking for when you go out to try to find an area?
Right. This is a great question, and I have to digress a little bit. One of the funny things about training in parkour is when you first start, you feel like there's no good areas around you. And what's really happening is you don't understand all of the capabilities that you have as a person to make that area good, to make that area fun. So now, just yesterday I was, or Sunday, sorry, rather, I was looking for a place to train. All I wanted was a single freestanding railing. That was all I wanted. And that was training for 3 hours. So as you progress in your training, almost the more simple the space, the more that you can find to do, the more that you can train your body on that area. The other answer to that question is just places with tons of stuff. So places that make immediately great and fun and diverse places to train tend to be things like college campuses, things that were built for a large amount of pedestrian traffic. So anywhere, because things there will tend to be people-sized, as opposed to a train station may not be great because train tracks may be 12 feet up or 3 feet down, but they're not meant for humans. So large cities, often in the middle of a large city, counterintuitive, is often not a great place because you've got 12 feet of sidewalk and 60 feet of building. And what can you do with that? So what you really want are smaller buildings. Things like loading docks are great. When someone sends me an email and says, hey, man, I want to start doing parkour. I live in this little town, and there is nowhere near me to train. I say, okay, you know what? Everybody gets their groceries from somewhere, and almost every grocery store in the world has a loading dock that's meant to fit a standard height 18-wheeler. So if it has a loading dock, it's going to have 5 or 6 stairs, it's going to have a handrail, and it's going to have a 3-foot concrete wall. And with those three things, the handrail, the stairs, and the 3-foot wall, you can practice so many different moves. You can practice forever there once you start to see the possibilities. So it's interesting that your capability and your ability and your ability to find spots all grow at the same time. So again, it's frustrating for beginners who could look at the best spot in the world and go, there's nothing for me to do here. And then a really advanced person might say, today I'm going to practice for 6 hours with me in a cinder block. And they'll tip it on different edges, and they'll do some hand balancing things, some foot balancing things, some precision drills. They'll do weight training drills with that cinder block. So again, the more advanced you are, the more simple of an environment you can make use of for good training.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because I remember, I don't have much experience in parkour, but just at the park a little while ago, there was a bench and a fence, but you can really drill down, do so many of the basic moves using just those two objects, so what you're saying makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Another question some people have asked, are there any legal concerns with practicing parkour, like in the loading dock? What should you do about that?
Sure, and this obviously is an issue in parkour. We advocate, along with safety, we advocate an idea that comes from hikers and climbers called leave no trace, and that means leave an area as good or better than you found it. So we do leave footprints on things. Sometimes we go back and clean them up. We don't leave trash. We try to clean areas, and we actually have leave no trace days where we go out with trash bags, and so far the members of APK nationwide collectively have picked up 105 bags of trash from different parks and different areas they train in. That doesn't mean that we're not sometimes asked to leave. So when we're asked to leave, the policy is move on. There's always another space that we can train. We don't want to piss anybody off. We're not there to give parkour a bad reputation of people that are disagreeable. We just want to train when we want to get along with our environment. Unfortunately, if there's a loose railing or a loose brick, we'll be the ones to find it. So stuff does sometimes break. We own up to it. We don't walk away. We say, hey, man, I was playing around on your fence, and I'm sorry it broke. What can I do to fix it? And that's how we're going to maintain a positive image for parkour. If people see people jumping on stuff and breaking it and walking away, and that's their perception of parkour, that's not what we want at all. So those are kind of more moral issues than legal. In terms of trespassing, it's interesting. You need to look at local codes, but in most places, trespassing is only enforceable by the owner of the property saying that you don't belong there. Because if we look at public space, and I can go on about this forever, I'll try and condense it. There is no such thing as public space in the United States of America. We have this concept of public space that we're allowed to have, but it really doesn't exist. If you think of any piece of property, it is either owned by the government, including national parks, or it is owned by a corporation, which usually has a building management company, which usually has a security guard, or it's owned by a private person, such as a house or something like that. Houses and land owned by private people, we really don't want to mess with, right? Don't ever go on somebody's roof. Just like where I used to live in Washington, D.C., somebody would come and spray paint my house. And I think, you know what, there's a big difference between spray painting somebody's house and spray painting a commercial building. I don't really agree with either. But if I catch someone spray painting my house, they're going to have a really bad day. So we don't train on people's private property when we can ascertain that that's what it is. And when you train on property that's belonging to one of these property management companies, it's kind of tricky because a person is allowed to walk through a plaza. A person is allowed to sit down at a restaurant and eat. A person is allowed to shop in that plaza and visit those stores. A person is even allowed to run or jog through that area. They would probably be allowed to do push-ups in that area. The second you vault over a railing, you're somehow violating every moral code that ever existed in the fabric of society, and society comes crumbling down. Obviously, I'm being a little sarcastic, but that's how it sometimes feels. We vault over a railing, and all of a sudden, people are calling the police. And it's like, okay, well, what did I do here? I'm exercising, I'm playing. So again, it's usually not worth the argument, and we just move on. But can they really say that you're trespassing? Well, they might be able to, but they'd probably have a hard time making it stick as well. Now, again, this is with the notion that you're not damaging something. You're not disturbing anybody else's peace. We don't jump around next to people. We don't scare people. We don't get in their way. If you're doing those things, well, then you're in the wrong. And that's pretty clear. And, hey, whatever happens to you. And please don't say you were doing parkour. Where on the other hand, if you're just off in a corner training on a rail or a bench or a fence and someone comes up and says you have to leave, you might say, hey, why aren't I allowed to exercise here? And maybe they'll have a good reason. They'll probably say because you'll get hurt, which is what we've been told since we were 10. So, you know, that's societal. But, legal concerns, that I think sums it up. I know I haven't given a very specific answer, but there isn't anything very specific. There have been a couple people who have actually been given tickets for doing parkour in a park, and I haven't heard of any that actually stuck through court. But these were park police that said, hey, you can't do that. You can't vault over that railing. And the person argued and said, well, I can vault over the railing, and sure enough, they get a ticket. We have an article on APK in terms of dealing with law enforcement. And the first thing is, as with anybody, be respectful. But with law enforcement, that's doubly important because their job is to determine when somebody's doing something out of the ordinary. And if you're crawling on a roof, you're doing something out of the ordinary, and you have to expect that they're going to have a certain reaction, and then you need to overcome their reaction. So you're really at a point of deficit. You're not, hey, I was walking down the sidewalk and this cop gave me a ticket. No, if you're crawling on a roof, you're doing something outside of societal norms, and you have to recognize that people are going to have some strange reactions, and you have to be extra patient, extra diligent in explaining to them what you're doing and why. And I don't like to say I'm doing parkour, it's a French discipline, it started blah blah blah. What do people care? You say, hey, I'm doing some exercise just by crawling around and using my body, and they go, oh, okay. And they understand that. And you say, do you mind if I keep practicing here? And they'll say yes or no. And if they say no, again, it's best to just move on because there's always other areas to train.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Okay, let's move back to towards some of the moves. We talked about you really got to spend time focusing on landings and learning how to roll. Is there anything specific you can say that maybe people who are trying this without getting some outside help that they can think and practice doing specific techniques?
Sure. The best one is to look up information on a bodyweight squat and pay specific attention to feeling the squat in your glutes and hamstrings. And if you can feel a squat in your glute hamstring chain, and then you can learn to land on the balls of your toes and control your descent with your glute hamstring chain, then you are going to be able to do safe landings. So again, what you're looking for is landing on the balls of your feet, never on your heels, because your heels aren't meant to take that shock, and you take out the shock absorber of your ankle if you land on your heel. So land on the balls of your feet and learn to absorb the shock using your glute hamstring chain with proper squat form. If you can do that, you'll develop safe landings. So proper squat form, in kind of 25 words or less, is feet slightly wider than shoulder width, toes pointed apart at about 30 degrees, knees out wide, chest up, butt sticking back, and again, tension in your lower back and hamstrings as you lower into the squat. So if you can master that in a dynamic sense, then you will have a pretty good basis for a safe landing.
I had one specific question about rolls, and I wanted to get this verbatim because it's fairly specific. When you do a parkour roll, should your legs feel as though they're collapsing, or should you feel your feet stop you slightly, then go into your roll? I've tried it both ways, and when I just let them collapse, I always hurt my back slightly, and if I use my legs to stop myself, I end up getting really sore legs after doing it 5 to 9 times.
Right, and that's actually a perfect example of what I was just talking about, and that's the difference between landing on the balls of your feet and not controlling your descent. So when this person says, should you let your legs collapse? No, don't let them collapse. It should be a controlled descent. And then he says, if I use my feet to stop me, it hurts my legs. That's because you're jarring yourself, and that's the opposite end of a controlled descent. So again, learning to control that range of motion through the descent where you're not just slamming into the ground and you're not just bouncing off the ground, somewhere in the middle of that is a good landing. Now, transferring that momentum into a roll is frankly a matter of whether you're a beginner, intermediate, or expert. When you're a beginner, you should absorb most of the impact with your legs, with that squat form, with your glute hamstring chain, chest up. You don't want to put your face down before you go into a roll, or you're going to become good friends with your dentist. So again, chest up, absorb the momentum with your legs by using your glute hamstring chain effectively as a braking mechanism. And then after you've collapsed, let's say 2/3 of the way, that's when you should go forward into your roll. Now, when you become more advanced, you can actually take more of the shock plyometrically with your legs, and you'll see more advanced practitioners, and Levi Muhlenberg made a great advanced rolling tutorial that talks about this very thing. You'll land, and it will be much more jarring on your legs, but again, this is after you've practiced for months or years to understand that whole range of motion, and your legs will become more solid, and you'll actually get more spring forward into your roll and transfer the momentum more effectively. But again, that's a more advanced move that people should learn the other way first, absorbing fully, then going into your roll, and as you become more advanced, you absorb less with your legs and use that more as a bounding spring into your forward roll.
Yeah, I think that's something important people need to realize. With there's so many small details that can go into even a basic move like landing or doing a roll, and this is really something you need to be practicing thousands of times to really get it good to the point where it's flawless and can be the same no matter what angle you're coming in from your landing or how you're doing the move.
Absolutely. And we practice with cones doing agility drills so that people land and redirect their momentum in a different direction, because in parkour also it's very important to be fairly ambidextrous. And I don't believe in true ambidexterity, because people will have a better side and a less better side. Mm-hmm. And if you only ever train your less better side, in some sense, you're limiting yourself, because people do have a strong side. So I feel that people need to train their, I'm going to call it their weak side, people need to train their weak side to a certain level of proficiency that it doesn't hinder them, but I don't think they need to necessarily make it better than their good side. So if you're going to land and there's some object that prohibits you from rolling to your right, you darn well better know how to roll to your left. Do you need to know how to roll as well to your left as you do to your right. Again, I'll leave that as situational, but you need to have at least functional movement on the left side of your body. If you're going to vault the railing, you don't get to decide where that railing is. You don't get to decide where the stairs are. If you're moving through an environment, obstacles are coming at you, and wherever they are, you need to find the best way over them. If you have to stop, turn, and then vault with your other hand, obviously that's ineffective.
Yeah, this is a little different from gymnastics, which I have a little experience in. You really always do the moves off the same foot. You'd take off, you'd work it so your spacing was the same, so your foot, and you always left off the one foot. But this is different because, yes, like you say, the obstacles are going to come different ways, so you need to have that proficiency to be able to go. Would you say you want to spend like 50% of time going each way, or just leave it up just with some practice to your weaker side?
Again, if you have to put a number on it, and this again is my personal opinion, I would say train at least 30% of your time on your weaker side so that it is proficient, so that it's not hindering you. But again, I don't feel that you need to train it 50% or 60% to make it as good as your naturally strong side, because it simply won't be. And you could spend your time with that as a pursuit, but to me personally, that's not the most useful use of your time. If you have a good side and you train it 60 to 70% of the time, and you train your weak side 30 to 40% of the time to a point of proficiency so that you can vault over something, and maybe you practice more of the basic moves on your weak side until you have the basic moves to a high level of proficiency. And if you're going to do something fancy like a reverse vault or a vault with a spin, or you want to learn flips and twists and spins, you do those always off your strong side, because those you're doing as a matter of choice. So you can say, okay, off this railing, I'm going to do a front flip. That you can always do off your right foot, because you're only doing it when you choose to. But the basic moves, a vault, a tic-tac, which is putting your foot on a wall to redirect your momentum, a cat leap, those things should be trained off of either foot, because there will be times when you're running at something and you can't necessarily gauge your footsteps exactly, which is something that we work on a lot. We call it running cadence, so that more often than not, you can take off from your strong foot, because that gives you a stronger position, obviously. However, you won't always be able to do that. There will be a piece of glass. There will be a dog that runs out in front of you. There will be something that prohibits you from doing that. So you better be at least proficient on the other side.
That makes a lot of sense. So let's talk a bit more about training. Let's say you have your basics down and you go out and find a place. How do you train in parkour? What do you do? Maybe talk about some specific, like when you say you go out and spend 3 hours with just a railing. What do you do during that time?
Sure. The first thing is always good advice, proper warm-up. So wherever you are, you don't need anything physical aside from the floor to do a good warm-up. If you do some light jogging, some joint rotation, mobility movements, throw in some burpees and some squats and box jumps, then you've done a pretty good warm-up. So I would say warm up for at least 15 minutes. And by warm-up, I mean actual physical movements. Standing and stretching is not a warm-up. So get in, actually do physical movements that move your muscles through a complete range and move as many of those muscle groups as possible. One of the things I didn't mention is crawling on all fours is a fantastic warm-up. That really moves a lot of muscles in your body, and it's a great, again, a warm-up move should be a low-impact, low-stress move. You're not shocking the muscle because the muscle is still cold. So warm-up is low-impact, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's easy. If you crawl on your hands and feet for 30 yards five times, that is not easy by any means. If you crawl up or down stairs, that is not easy, but it is fairly low impact. So those are great warm-up moves. So a good training session, in my opinion, always starts with a warm-up so that your body is warm and pliable and ready to learn something new. And then, again, start with progressions. Whatever you're going to train. The other day I did something that scares me, and I love days when I do something that scares me because I feel like I've learned, I feel like I've advanced. But what I was doing was running up to a place where there was a concrete bench about 6 feet from a tree, and about 6 feet off the ground in the tree, there was a nice Y shape in the tree. And I was running up, putting one foot on the bench, jumping and putting my other foot in the Y shape of the tree, and then swinging off a branch through the tree. And to get to this, I obviously didn't run up, jump off the bench, put my foot on the tree, and swing through. There are other people who have practiced a lot more than me, who are a lot more capable than me, who probably could just run up and do that movement. For me, it was a matter of running up, putting my foot on the bench, jumping in the air, jumping next to the tree, seeing what my distance was, then jumping and just from the ground, tapping my foot on the tree, making sure I was comfortable with my foot's contact with the tree, then jumping higher up, making sure that I was going to have grip, making sure I was going to have a good landing surface. And again, I might be more cautious than other practitioners, but hopefully that will save me and give me more longevity in my training. And eventually I did work up to a point where I was comfortable, and at some point you just have to kind of go for it, because you can't sometimes replicate the exact movement without actually doing it. And so I built up progressively to the point where I then took about 3 or 4 running steps, launch off this bench, get my other foot 6 feet up in this tree, grab a branch, swing through, and boom, that felt great. And so that was probably a 20-minute progression for me, getting through, getting over covering the distance between the bench and the tree, which might have been 6 to 8 feet, getting the idea that I was going to land 6 or 7 feet up in this tree, and that if I missed, I was going to have to deal with that. So I even a couple times jumped to the tree and grabbed the branch and swung down without putting my foot on. So, you know, having an out, having an emergency out in case you miss the move is often a good plan. So that was one thing that I trained. Another thing that I trained was just a precision jump onto a railing. So I went up to the railing and from the ground jumped up and stuck my foot on it and said, okay, it's solid. Then I jump up and stick my foot on it and do a little bit of a push back. And I say, okay, it'll hold my weight. Then I jump up and put my foot on it and maybe sort of balance at a 45-degree angle for a half a second and say, okay, it's not that slippery. And then I jump up from the ground and land on top of the railing. Okay, great. I've jumped and landed on the railing. Then I go to a railing that's 6 feet away, get on that railing, and jump across to the other railing. So again, a progression to train, and that progression may have taken me 10 to 15 minutes to work up to that move where I felt comfortable to jump onto the railing that's 3 feet off the ground, and then I felt comfortable to jump to it from another railing that's also 3 feet off the ground that's 6 feet away. So I have to know that I can jump that distance, and I have to know that my landing is a safe spot. So that's another thing in parkour. Always check your surfaces. And that's always check your surfaces. So look for broken glass. Don't just vault over something unless you know what's on the other side. More than one person has met an untimely finish by vaulting over something only to find there's nothing on the other side. You hear about this in police chases where guys go off the side of a highway and vault and find out that there's a 60-foot embankment down to another busy highway. And that's not what you want to do in parkour training. Granted, if you're being chased by a Rottweiler, vault over it, right? Do whatever you need to do. But if you're training, check your surfaces, move progressively. Also in that training session, I worked on some bar muscle ups, and so that's a progression of doing a pull up and getting the kip right and getting up over the bar and doing bar muscle ups. And I mean, really, the opportunities for training are endless. So other things to do on that railing, one thing I did practice that I haven't practiced before was just falling off the railing. And again, it's always a good idea to know what's going to happen if you miss the move that you're attempting so that you don't freak out, so that you have options. Instead of landing split-footed on a rail and catching that in the crotch, which is the worst thing you can do, you want to learn to bounce off it and land on the ground. And then you are basically minimizing the sorry, I'm lost for the word here. You're minimizing the impact of missing. You're minimizing the consequences of missing that movement. So you want to know what the consequences of missing a movement are and minimize those consequences as much as you can.
Yeah, just hearing you talk about training session, I think when a lot of people think about training in parkour, they think back to the videos they've seen where a person is just doing moves off of one object and keep on going and moving on to the next, and not finding a specific object or a couple different objects and practicing over and over again the same move or the series of moves leading up to something, and just in a training session really focusing on that rather than just running from place to place.
Exactly. And for me, that's kind of a definition and semantics, and again, people have different views on this. I say that people very rarely do parkour and much more often train for parkour. So you could argue that training for parkour is building up this tool set, right? You want to learn how to land, you want to learn how to roll, you want to learn how to do simple vaults over simple obstacles, then you can practice landing from slightly higher objects. And again, we don't just advocate going out and jumping off high things, but you can begin to practice more complex moves, more complex environments. And then one day for me, parkour is when you go out and you say, all right, I'm just going to go. And it doesn't matter where you're going, in my opinion, just go. And when there's an obstacle that's in your way, get over it. And don't think, okay, I'm going to put my left foot here and my right hand here and do a move which has this technically named vault. You know, I'm going to do a speed vault, a reverse vault, a dash vault, a Kong vault. Whatever name the move is really is unimportant at that point. What's important is that you've built this toolkit that when you come to the obstacle, you do it instinctively. So I would say that that's the difference between training for parkour and doing parkour. And following that argument, I would say people spend a lot more time training for parkour than they do doing parkour.
Okay. Could you give some advice as far as training frequency? And is it possible that you can train too much?
Is it possible that you can train too much? Not bloody likely. What is possible is that you can under-nutritionalize, under-hydrate, and under-rest. What most people can't do is actually overtrain. The human body is an amazing, amazing apparatus that can take a ton of stuff thrown at it at any given time. And I'm a firm believer that every once in a while, you should go and train right after you just ate. And that goes against all conventional wisdom, but what happens if there's an emergency situation and you just ate? Are you going to sit and digest for a half an hour before you move to the place where somebody needs help or you need to escape a situation? Of course not. So someday you're going to need to do that. Parkour training is more dangerous in the rain or snow, but should you train it? Of course you should. It's part of moving through your environment. So, and that also goes with overtraining. I think people typically tend to think of body parts and training, oh, today I'm going to do upper body and then I need to rest my upper body for 2 or 3 days. And that may have some merit in terms of strictly building muscle, but the idea of training parkour isn't to build big muscles to look a certain way. The idea of training parkour is to gain functional strength and utilize that functional strength. So what happens if you're in a situation where you do have to use your legs? Oh my God, working legs 3 days in a row? Sure, happens all the time. So I think it's very unlikely that someone will overtrain. They'll become sore, and you should always do gentle, low-impact moves the next day and stretch after you work out to minimize that soreness. But to me, soreness is part of life. If I can make myself sore in a workout, I feel pretty happy for that because it means I move something. It means I challenge something. And humans grow through challenge, through stress. If you don't place stress on a human body, it atrophies. So, and I know in large part in speaking with your crowd here that I'm preaching to the choir, but can you overtrain? Everyone who goes out for their first parkour jam, as we call it, these big parkour get-togethers, the next day cannot walk upstairs. Their quads hurt so bad, their stomach hurts so bad from all the jumping and running they did, forgetting that it's a form of exercise, because you just go out and you play for 4 hours straight and man, you hurt the next day something awful. And nobody that does parkour will ever forget the way they felt 2 days after their first day. So And to me, that's just fun and funny and part of life. But in general, can you overtrain? No. Keep up proper nutrition. Keep up proper hydration. Always get proper rest. And then in that case, it's extremely unlikely that somebody could actually overtrain. Now, training above somebody's level is an entirely different story, and that's pretty easy to do with parkour. All you have to do is walk outside and jump off something 6 feet tall, and you will hurt something. So again, the difference between overtraining and training above your level should be very clear. You should train things that are within your grasp, and what you do is slowly increase your capabilities. If you train things that are outside of your grasp, you will very quickly put yourself in a world of hurt and set back your training and do more harm than good.
On that note, can you give some advice on keeping the joints, especially the ankles and the knees, healthy when practicing parkour? Is there things you should be doing before and after training?
Sure, absolutely. Again, a proper warm-up is essential. You do not want to be tugging on ligaments and tendons when they're in a cool state and the muscles are in a cool state and things are likely to bind up. You want to get those things good and warm. Go through joint rotations, mobility drills before you train. Go through warm-up before you train, and also after you train to move things around. I know this isn't very scientific, but there is some science behind it. When you move joints, you increase the blood flow, and that increases healing. So anytime that you can improve circulation to an area, you're improving healing of that area. And anytime that you work an area, you are, in fact, causing it damage, whether it's micro stress or however you want to look at it. And that damage is positive because it's the regrowth from that damage that builds strength. So, yes, you do want to do joint rotations. You want to do mobility drills and things like that. Before and after you train, you want to stretch. And again, for me, stretching is primarily after you train. You don't want to stretch a cold muscle because it has limited functionality. If you stretch the muscle when it's warm and pliable, for me, that's a better idea. The other thing, of course, is, again, work to your own level. If you go out and you jump off a 6-inch curb 100 times, your legs are going to be sore, but you're not going to do permanent damage to your knees. If you go out your first day and jump off something 6 feet tall 3 times, you can do permanent damage to your knees and ankles. So that's not what you want. So again, progression is really the key to safety.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. You want to start with something that's well within your capabilities, and by jumping off that 6-inch curb, it's going to condition your knees, your ankles to take that strain, and from that you can build up rather than starting too high, again, like we talked about before, and then just going after, and that can cause problems down the road.
Right, that's exactly how it goes. And there's no shortcut to that. No matter, I feel like saying, dear listener, no matter what you think of your physical abilities, don't take the shortcut. Find out through experimentation and find out through proper scaling. Don't find out because you pushed it too far and you found out the wrong way.
Yes, start well within your abilities and expand from there rather than starting out at the height of where you can do and then trying to expand, because in the long run you'll do much better. Not only you'll get further with the skills and techniques, but you're also going to protect yourself from injury.
Absolutely.
On that note again, how would you train to jump further and higher? Do you have some specific ways you work on that?
Yes, jump further and higher. So really, again, doing squats, and this is somewhere that weighted squats come into play. Really, there are no greater strength-building movements for the human body than the Olympic weightlifting lifts. So if you look at deadlifts, snatches, clean and jerk, learning these moves will be the greatest way to increase your jump capability, bar none. So doing them weighted with bands, and you should really seek advice on those moves. Those lifts are not something where you walk up to a bar and you try and do a clean and jerk or you try and do a snatch. You will get hurt. These are moves that take skill. They take coaching. There are progressions for the moves that you should learn. And you really should have somebody else look at your form, because even if you think you're taking all the time to learn it properly, most people do not have a perfect self-image of the movement they're doing. You could videotape it and try and be your own coach, but wouldn't it be better to seek a coach in Olympic lifting who knows what they're doing and have them look at your form? And then again, deadlifts, squats, and snatches and clean and jerks are extremely powerful moves. And if you look at Olympic weightlifters, they have some of the best sprint times and some of the best vertical leaps in all of athletics because they've built up that explosive power in that glute hamstring chain.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible explosive power. One question, if you travel a lot, what would you say, how can you train or stay up on your skills when you're out there on the road all the time?
That is the best possible way to train and stay up on your skills is by traveling. You find new areas, so you're training your brain as well as your body. Because you go to a new place, and again, it's a matter of finding what is around you. And this is both physical and mental. It's a matter of finding what is around you, adapting your training to your environment, and learning to use your environment to train. Kids' playgrounds are pretty abundant. Wherever you travel, you're going to find one of those. And you can always do pull-ups and pull-up progressions. And obviously, you can do handstand progressions with nothing but a wall. And if you're past that point, then you don't even need a wall. You can just use the floor. And handstand work, obviously, is such a hugely beneficial form of exercise for the body. It works so much of balance, control, strength, coordination, and even endurance when you start to hold positions. So that, planche progressions, lever progressions, there's so many gymnastic moves that you can practice with nothing. And then if you take those and you apply them to whatever area you're in, and you say, hey, here's a 6-foot wall next to a 3-foot wall, what can I do here? Here's a railing next to a curb, what can I do here? Here's a tree that has these branches that are different than any other tree I've ever seen. Can I jump from one branch to another? Can I grab this one and swing and grab the other? So infinite possibilities. And for me, traveling is a big part of the joy of parkour, is traveling around, not only meeting other people, but just always seeing new areas and seeing how people have adapted their training to the areas they train in and learning something new every single time and every single place.
I agree with you there. I found it interesting. I got started with the hand balancing, and that led me into some gymnastic acrobatic skills, and that led me into trying out parkour. And there's people coming from the other direction that get into parkour and they see other people doing the handstand, so they get into that. Really, all these different arts skills, they have one big thing in common. It's learning how to control your body. And the better you can do that, the better you'll be at everything.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think hand balancing, and I'm so glad it's called hand balancing instead of handstanding. Balance is such a huge part of human capability, and for me, it's something when I train kids, I'm not training them to do big jumps. I'm not training them to do drops. They are learning properly land and roll, but so much of what I work on is balance, because whether they choose to go into gymnastics, martial arts, kind of typical team sports, if they have solid balance, then that's a whole part of their brain that doesn't need to be occupied with where they are in space. They're comfortable even if they're slightly off balance. If they're at an angle, they're comfortable. Their muscles understand how to react to that instinctively, instead of their mind being occupied with, oh no, I'm leaning back slightly, what can I do now? They're comfortable there, and that allows them to focus on whatever task is at hand, whether it's, again, in martial arts, gymnastics, or throwing a basketball towards a hoop as you're starting to fall back, right? If you're worried about where your body is in space and you really have to focus on that, then you're not going to be focused on putting that ball in the net. So I think balancing and hand balancing are really, again, hugely beneficial in that area, and not to mention the upper body strength that hand balancing builds. And there's a lot of parts of parkour that use hand balancing and walking up or down stairs just as a challenge. And again, it's not that walking down a flight of stairs on your hands is necessarily ever going to be the best way to get somewhere in an emergency, but there may in fact be a time where you have to crawl through a space that's low, so your legs aren't your major locomotive feature, and your hands are. And if you've learned to walk and balance on your hand down a flight of stairs, then you're going to be much more efficient and much more effective at crawling under barbed wire or crawling through a narrow space.
Okay, we're coming up right upon an hour here, so just to end the call, could you talk a little bit about AmericanParkour.com, what people can find there, and also the parkour tutorial DVD you put together?
Sure, I'd love to talk about American Parkour. There are a lot of people that have made American Parkour into what it is. It's actually the world's largest parkour and free running community. We get about 90,000 visitors a month from 165 countries. So it really is a global website, despite the name American Parkour. And what it is we've just tried to make the site useful for anyone who wants to learn, find out more about parkour, and become part of the parkour community. So really, that's our main goal, is to provide useful information and a good entry point into practicing parkour. Finding other practitioners, as you mentioned before, is a big part of it. So we have a great section called Getting Started that walks someone through day one or day zero of their parkour journey. And then we have nutrition, information articles, right up through very advanced practitioners. So we really span the range of that. And it's the input that we've gotten from the community, from groups. There's a professional performance group called the Tribe, another group called the APK Alliance, who just contribute so much to the site to make it the most useful parkour and free running website out there. So again, you can find tutorials, you can find pictures, you can find videos, you can find the forums, the community. We have a store that sells gear, some training gear, and then some stuff like t-shirts and water bottles. One of the things obviously that we carry in the store is the tutorial DVD, and that's actually our most popular product because it's something that allows people to get into parkour. And again, you carry that on your site, and so many of your members have been interested in that. It's a great DVD that really it is the basics. It's for someone new, and it's for someone who's starting out in parkour. And it goes through these movements: jumping, landing, rolling, vaulting, tic tacs, wall climbs, monkey vaults, lazy vaults, speed vaults, all these different basic moves. And it goes through them in really great depth. It explains the move 5 or 6 times for each move. It says, look out for this, make sure you're doing this. So really, it's a pretty in-depth tutorial that covers the movements that you're going to need. And again, it needs to be emphasized that those movements alone are not parkour. It's taking those movements as building blocks, practicing them thousands of different times in different places in different ways that will eventually allow you to just go out and run and go where you want to go and be free to move the way you want to move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to agree that the moves you have on that DVD alone could keep someone busy just practicing those skills for a really long time, whether you're just getting started or have some experience already. So anyone that's looking to get started, I highly recommend that.
Great, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for being on the call, Mark. I got a lot out of this interview. I think it went into some places that didn't expect it, and there's a lot of great information. So I encourage you to listen to it over and over again and get started and let me know how you do in your training.
Great. Thanks again for having me, and I look forward to seeing how your community uses this interview, hopefully to help them to get started. And of course, we welcome everyone over at American Parkour, and again, we discussed getting more people in American Parkour to become part of your community, because I think there is so much in common. So I look forward to seeing the two groups grow together.
All right, thank you very much, Mark.
Great, thank you.